Please stand for the reading of the gospel. The Holy Gospel this morning is from the 8th chapter of St. John. Now early in the morning, Jesus came again to the temple in Jerusalem. All the people came to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and making her stand before all of them, they said to her, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now, in the law of Moses, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. Now, what do you say?" They said this to test him, so that they might have some charge to bring against him. But Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again he bent down and wrote on the ground. Now, when they heard it, they went away, one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Then Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, do not sin again." This is the gospel of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Oh, yes, thank you, Dave. We invite our children to go now with Miss Stacy to the back of the church. They will return following the sermon. We are in a sermon series called Awkward Conversations, Faithful Response. And as we've mentioned before, and last week if you were here, that we've all been in these places, right? Awkward situations, or been in the middle of some bad or awkward conversations, times when we're left dumbfounded, or maybe times where we just want to slip out of the room unnoticed. In the summer, after my fifth grade, I was enrolled in a sex ed class at my doctor's office. Yeah, my female doctor, I should say, whose name I can't remember, but she was brand new to the practice. Nothing against female doctors, of course, but I was a fifth grade boy. I should add that I was signed up unknowingly. So I show up for class, and when you know it, the class included boys and girls, five or six of us crowded together in a small meeting room. I cannot remember how many weeks it took, but I remember her being extremely thorough with the topic. And I remember hardly ever saying a word. When it was over, and rest assured, it could not have been soon enough, we went on our own way. Until the first day of school, no longer elementary school, making our way to middle school, brand new day, brand new life, brand new journey, brand new place, stepped into homeroom. Literally, the first person I lay eyes on is a girl who was in that class. I put my head down, and I did not talk to her the rest of the school year. Awkward. Unfortunately, not all talk surrounding sex is funny. The sex trafficking industry has ruined lives left and right. Since January 1st of this year, now that's just, what, 3-4 weeks ago, 297 calls have been made to the North Carolina Sex Trafficking Hotline, mostly teenage girls and young women, but 20% of those calling have been young men. 2 weeks ago in Tennessee, and maybe you read about this, it was all over the place, I believe. The governor of Tennessee pardoned Centoya Brown, who was given life in prison when she was 16 years old for murdering a man who had paid to have sex with her and had turned overly aggressive and violent. As it turns out, Centoya had been lured into the sex trafficking industry and she was scared for her life. She was tried as an adult, 16 years old, and she had to serve 14 years in an adult women's prison before the governor, just a couple of weeks ago, finally had mercy on her. Maybe you've heard the statistics. 1 in 5 women will be raped at some point in their lives. 25% of college women are victims of forced sex during their college years. The emotional cost is terrific. It's usually lifelong. But as you know, there's a monetary cost. Each year, rape costs the U.S. economy $127 billion. Let that sink in. It's more than any other crime. In fact, more than drunk driving and murder combined. It's amazing. Now, it's hard to place it within the category of awkward conversation, and yet it's one of those things that we simply don't talk about for whatever reason. Well, today, Jesus talks about it. So I'd invite you to open up to your gospel reading, if you will, to John chapter 8. Let's take a look at this remarkable story, this honest story of Jesus. Here's the story in a nutshell. It's the story of a woman caught in the act of adultery. I know that's not prostitution, although there are plenty of commentators who have made a very compelling case that probably she was in that prostitution industry because she was well known, likely, and it was easy to find her, catch her, know what she was doing, and then drag her into a very public place. In any case, what we know from the scripture itself is that she was caught in an act of adultery. She was dragged by force into a public gathering place, humiliated by sin, separated from anyone to protect her, judged and sentenced to death without trial by self-righteous leaders, and then placed before Jesus in order to trick him into defending a woman who the law says must be stoned to death. In other words, as John Shea says, she's caught, she's brought, and she's made to stand there. Verbs, of course, of power and of control and of dominance that tend to define her sin and are designed to keep her in her place, right? Oh, and did you notice? The man gets off scot-free, which is what seems to happen far too often, right? Especially in the sex industry, where sheer power is used to control and manipulate and humiliate, all for a particular gain, whatever that gain may be, a sexual favor or a financial gain or whatever it might be. This story is about all of that, of course. I mean, it's a story about adultery or maybe prostitution or maybe both, who knows? But it's at the very least a story about a woman who's caught in the act. And she's forced to take full responsibility for her sin. Ezekiel goes farther in the description and says that she would be stripped naked and that after she's stoned to death, her house would literally be burned to the ground. They took this stuff seriously. What's awkward about any of that? Well, there's nothing awkward about what's happening to this woman. It's brutal, but it's not awkward. What's awkward is what happens next. The conversation between Jesus and the religious leaders, between those who are willing to judge her and condemn her, and the one who is so eager to love her and to give her a second chance. Here's what I mean. Take a look at verse 4 in this remarkable story. Verse 4. These religious leaders say to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. Now, what do you say?" Now, not surprising, these religious leaders have caught this woman, and they are holding her in her sin. I mean, we do it all the time, right? I mean, it is sort of part of the human game. We label people according to their sin. We define them according to their past transgressions, whether they're small or large, it hardly matters. And we talk about it all the time, under our breath or maybe publicly, who knows, just right out in the open. There's a great line in Steel Magnolias when Clarice says, "You know what they say, if you don't have anything nice to say about anybody, come sit by me." We like to hold people to their sin. We like to talk about their sin. Why? I don't know. Maybe it makes us feel better about ourselves. I don't really know, but we rarely forget it. It's as if we don't want to forget it. Here's the point. The Pharisees only saw the sin in this woman. That's all they saw, all they cared about. They only saw her distortion. They refused to see anything more than that. I have to say that in the middle of the 8:30 service, for whatever reason, I think the Lord placed before me the image of someone from our former congregation in Virginia, a lady named Angela, who early in my career there, so this would have been probably mid to late 1990s, Angela showed up in my office. Now, I can't remember when I started there, I was the only paid employee, and maybe we had a part-time secretary at the time. I don't remember. It doesn't matter. But Angela shows up. And people occasionally did. It was a 4-lane divided highway. And so we would pretty regularly get some folks who were coming in needing assistance. I assumed Angela needed assistance. But she never once asked for monetary help or assistance in that regard. But she looked, and forgive me, she looked like hell. Her hair was all messed up. Her clothing was just dirty, and I could see in her arms, maybe I was making it up, I don't know, but it just looked like she had been doing drugs of some kind or another. What she told me was that she was living the life of a prostitute, and she had been for years. She was tired, she was exhausted, she was afraid, she was desperate, but she didn't know how to get away. Now, Angela would show up periodically, every 6-9 months or so, and she'd tell me the story again, still feeling, looking exhausted. And anytime it'd make any kind of movement to trying to find some kind of help or move her to that kind of help that put an end to the conversation, she would get up and leave almost immediately. Several years later, and my chronology is probably a little bit off, we were going to the Frederick County Fair. And I remember Anna was with me, and we were going, I feel like it was to the Tilt-A-Whirl. And I saw Angela. She was working. She was one of the fair workers, and she was taking the tickets. And so I saw her, and so wanted to go over to say hello to her, but she saw me too and immediately hid. She immediately stepped away, tried to hide from me for whatever reason, but she was ashamed. But for whatever reason, I kept pursuing it and eventually got to that place where I saw her and said, "Hi, Angela." And she would not even look me in the eye. And she said, "I'm better than you think I am. I'm better than you think I am." You know, I have to admit that sometimes we are those folks who hold others and remember their sin. We hold them in that sin. I remember seeing her and realizing now that as I reflect back on it that I only was capable, I guess, of seeing her through the lens of her mistake, through the lens of this life of prostitution. I was holding her to this sin because the sin was the filter through which I approached her and was relating with her. To me, this was the woman who was a prostitute, right? This is a woman who lived the life of that kind of sex industry. And as a result, I guess, I just was not able or willing to let it go. I don't know, but I was holding on to it. Totally unfair. This life of looking backwards, of dwelling in her negative past. I realized now that, you know, as I did that, I was keeping her in some kind of prison. I was keeping her in chains of shame and guilt. And when she saw me, those chains just were tightened, it seemed, around her wrists and around her ankles. But I also realized that I was sort of keeping myself in a place of prison, not allowing myself to see the joy and the new life that is beyond, that is possible beyond her sin, and so remaining stuck in a place maybe of judgment or of condemnation. Thankfully, through this amazing and brilliant story, Jesus shows us another way. You see, when the Pharisees drag this woman in front of Jesus, they ask, "What would you do?" They're trying to trick him, of course. The law says to stone her. Now, they had heard Jesus. They had heard his message, his sermons, his teaching about love and forgiveness and second chances. They knew all about that. So they brought this woman to a public place. They drug her into the middle of that place and said, now, let's see what you have to say, Jesus, right? I mean, the law says to stone her. What about you? They were doing their best to bait him. But what happens next is classic. He knows they're trying to bait him, but he doesn't take the bait. Instead, Jesus steps back. He takes a breath, and he starts drawing in the dirt. I love this picture on the front of the bulletin cover, don't you? I mean, at one level, he gets on her level, doesn't he? Right? He refuses to stand on the level of the rest of the folks in the audience, but instead gets on her level and begins drawing in the dirt. Who knows what he's drawing? It doesn't necessarily matter, but I do know, again, there are plenty of times when I should have kept my mouth shut in an argument, right? I should have stepped back and taken a breath I shouldn't have sent that text message that quickly, or I shouldn't have said that comment around the dinner table that maybe would, I know, get me in trouble the second it left my lips, but Jesus shows us a different way there too. He takes a breath, he collects himself, he gains control, even when they keep berating him. Did you see that in Scripture? They keep on pushing him, they keep on questioning him, until in verse 7, and this is brilliant, I love it. I love the way John describes this in verse 7. When they keep on questioning him, Jesus straightens up, and he said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Isn't that classic? I mean, is there a better comeback than that? I mean, a better response? I mean, don't you? I just want to pull Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi into a room and say those very same words, don't you? Not that it'd go anywhere, but who knows? But it's more than just a good comeback. In fact, there's a particular nuance in what Jesus is saying that's really very important to hear. To understand it, we need to step back into the history of the Jewish people, the children of Israel, hundreds of years, of course, before the birth of Jesus. Now, keep in mind, as you probably know, these are the people that God chose to be his covenant people, the shining light on a hill to reveal God's glory to all of the world, a small group of people to be a light to the world. These are the people that he guided across the Red Sea. These are the people that he gave the promised land. These are the people that he helped defeat Goliath and the Philistines. These are the people who, with David, he helped to build the city of Jerusalem. I mean, it's a very special relationship. God would say to them, "I am your God. You are my people. I will not forsake you." This is a special, remarkable relationship. But the people struggled, and they fell astray. They turned their backs on God, and they worshiped other gods. Now, in Hebrew tradition, and this is what's important, every time they pulled away from God, it was envisioned as adultery. When the children of Israel would lust after other gods. Why? Because they didn't believe in the love of God. They didn't trust in God's covenant. It happened over and over and over again, and it literally broke God's heart. Finally, to the prophet Hosea, God said, "Go and marry a woman who is an adulteress, and you'll see how I feel." So when these religious leaders catch this adulteress, and they drag her in front of everyone, and they pompously call her a sinner, Jesus must have thought to himself, "Are you serious? It's like the pot calling the kettle black. And now you're asking me to condemn her?" Oh, Israel, he must have thought, the great adulteress of all times. You are alive today not because God condemned you, but because God continued to forgive you. And the same is true for us. We are alive today not because God has condemned us, but because God, through his grace and mercy, continues to forgive us. That's why we sing Amazing Grace. How sweet the sound. Here's the question for you this week, and I'd love for you to ponder it this week. Will you remain beholden to a past that's rooted in sin, either your own or someone else's? Or are you open to a future that's made alive again by the grace and forgiveness of God? I love the story of a young lady who migrated to the United States from Cuba. Being a devout Catholic, she wanted to attend confession, and she wanted to confess her sins in English because she was in the United States. She felt like she was supposed to confess in English, and she wanted to do so. So she had a friend translate her list of sins into English because she didn't speak it, and this friend wrote the words out phonetically so that she could say them using this limited knowledge of this new language. Well, taking her place in the confession booth, she was so nervous, and she said the first phrase that she had memorized with a thick Spanish accent. She said, "Father, forgive me, for I have sinned." And then she looked down at the list, but it was too dark in the booth for her to read it. And so she said again, hoping her eyes would maybe adjust to the dim light. She said again, "Father, forgive me, for I have sinned." But then she still couldn't see. She still couldn't read it. So in obvious frustration, she said in Spanish, "I can't see my sins." And the priest laughed and said in Spanish, "Oh, dear child, neither can God. You are forgiven. So go and sin no more." It's not that God doesn't care about your sin. He does. Sin separates us, can destroy us. Sin can rip apart relationships in a skinny minute. It's just that God doesn't want you to be defined by your sin. Because God is always preparing you for the dawn of a new day, the blessing of a new tomorrow. He's always moving us from cross to resurrection, from death to light, from darkness to light. He wants that for you. It's so deep in the heart of God. He wants that for you, to trust in His love, to trust in His grace and in His forgiveness. But friends, He wants that for your neighbor too. And please hear this, because it's so very true. He also wants it for the person that you're having a hard time forgiving right now. The person you're thinking about at this very moment. You continue to hold them in sin? Or will you see them as Jesus sees them, as a precious child of God? Well, today, friends, you and I have decided to gather again for worship in this very public place, in this temple of God. And isn't it remarkable that in this very place, Jesus straightens up and looks us in the eye, you and me, and says, "Oh, precious child, go in my love and sin no more." Amen.